Today on the Burning Archive, I bring you a fascinating interview with Warwick Powell on a better way to conduct Australia-China relationships.
Often people have this sense of wish. They wish that something is. And that does often cloud the way that you approach the world. If you can become mindful of the fact that we all have our own wishes and our normative perspectives, but be conscious of what they are and leave them at the door, right? And let the voices of others just wash over you. Right? Just let them be. That's actually, from my perspective, a nice starting posture. And if we go back to the earlier comment, which is that I've lived and breathed this challenge, you know, this cross-cultural challenge my life, a part of dealing with that is to actually accept that what I may wish may not be what the other wishes for.
I am Jeff Rich. Welcome to the Burning Archive. This is a podcast about helping you see the world more clearly with the benefit of some quality world history and a few great interviews with people about current affairs. Warwick Powell, my guest today on the Burning Archive, is a man of many parts. He studied and taught Chinese history before becoming an advisor to former Australian Prime Minister Kevin Rudd. He founded a business, he became an adjunct professor, and he comments broadly on geopolitics and, I guess, Australia-Asia affairs. He himself was born in Hong Kong, lived in Macau, and moved to Australia in his youth. And we had a fascinating conversation about Australia, China, history, foreign policy, the role of the United States, the emerging multipolar world. And it was all prompted initially by the question of what went wrong in Australia-China relationships over the last decade or so, and how Warwick's personal experience informed his view about that. I hope you enjoy this wonderful, enriching, and in some ways inspiring interview. If you haven't already done so, why don't you subscribe to my free weekly newsletter on my Substack at jeffrich.substack.com, subscribe to the YouTube channel, and you might even want to check out my online history courses at courses.jeffrichwriter.com. Okay, on to the interview. Welcome to the Burning Archive, Warwick Powell.
Hey, how are you? Good to be with you.
Warwick, we're going to be talking about, I guess, the Australia-China relationship and what's happened to that relationship over the last decade or so. This channel, this podcast is really about what I say is helping people see the world more clearly with some quality world history. And I guess one of the big questions people all around the world are asking at the moment is, you know, where will the US-China relationship go? And last year I had on the show renowned historian Felipe Fernandez Mesto, who expressed a hope I think lots of people around the world have that Australia could somehow be a mediator of the tensions between the US and China. But over the last 10 years or so, those hopes have really been sort of dashed, it seems, with nuclear submarines and trade disputes and hostile political rhetoric on both sides. And I guess it would be great to talk with you about what your observations about what's happened, what went wrong, why, and what a better way might be. But perhaps just to start, do you want to just give us a sense of the, because you've really been a bit of a participant observer in the development and deterioration of that relationship over the last 30 years or so. What's the kind of perspective that you bring to bear on looking at this issue?
Well, I've lived this relationship my entire life, Jeff. I was born in Hong Kong. Dad's Australian, mum's Chinese, which makes me half-half. And when I say I've lived this relationship my entire life, I mean it both in a, you know, in the skin sense, but also in an active engagement sense, because my entire life has involved engaging with people from both sides of the cultural divide, if you will, both sides of the linguistic divide, and doing that from both a position where I was growing up in Macau many years ago now, and of course subsequently from a position in Australia after we moved here. Now, I've been in Australia a long time now, more than four decades, and I've put a lot of effort into fine-tuning my Australian accent, and I think based on all feedback, I've mastered it. But it doesn't always make myself particularly Australian sometimes, and the last few years I've felt that particularly acutely. And I say that because the last few years has seen an outburst, if you will, of both verbal and physical violence towards people of Chinese and more broadly Asian descent. And I've experienced it myself. And so in many respects, the Australia that I thought that I had become incredibly familiar with became an Australia that was in many ways a very unfamiliar Australia in the last, you know, few years. So that's caused me to, I guess, draw on both my personal history and also my economic and professional work over the last 30 years to try and figure out, at least give myself a chance of figuring out what's going on. And, you know, to have a chance to share some of that hopefully will contribute to the purposes of your channel and help people reflect on their own perspectives about these relationships and why they matter and what might happen to them.
And that's a really interesting observation, because obviously there's the, you know, big high profile political events, the, you know, AUKUS and all that sort of stuff, and political tensions and stuff that goes on in the media. But there's also a kind of a social, ordinary citizen sort of experience of all that, which it's really, well, it's distressing to hear that you've had those bad experiences. But I guess what then is your assessment of what has happened to the Australia-China relationship, especially over the last decade or so?
What's happened over the last decade probably makes sense if we think about what's happened over the last 200 years. In many ways, a young country often struggles with the idea that history matters. I guess your show will hopefully help people realise that history matters more than we often think it does. The last 10 years, of course, at certain levels has seen a deterioration of official relationships, if you will, particularly in terms of the ways in which public rhetoric has been mobilised about China and to some extent vice versa. That, of course, actually hasn't particularly impacted the economic relationship, which I think is a very important element of the dynamic between the two countries, and perhaps it acts as something of a ballast as well. But it's not just a ballast, it's also a source of friction, and it's not friction really between Australia and China. The proximity economically of Australia and China has given other parties cause for concern, and sometimes I think it's probably fair to say that they're isn't really a bilateral relationship between Australia and China, but a trilateral relationship between Australia, China, and the United States. So what's happened over the last 10 years really is a function of dynamics involving not only Australia and China, but more significantly, Australia and the United States and the United States and China. I say that we need to put a lot of this into a longer historical context, because the question that I often ask myself, and in part in reflection of that experience during the last few years of that outbreak of physical and verbal violence, which for me was quite unfamiliar. I mean, I've experienced racism when I was growing up, but it it actually hadn't been quite as intense, Jeff, as it has been over the last few years. And I wondered to myself, under what conditions is it possible for this level of violence, in effect, to emerge so quickly and so easily in a population vis-a-vis peoples from other parts of the world or who look different or have different skin colour or whatever? And that led me to think about Australia's relationships with China over the long durée. So, you know, if we're historians here, I guess I draw on some of the ideas of Braddell in thinking about how we get a grip on today in the context of the long durée, the big structural patterns of history, as well as the conjunctural issues. So if we look at the big structural patterns of history, ever since white settlement, Australia's largely had a very conflicted relationship with China and the Chinese, which has in many ways defined, in my view, a foundational feature of the Australian identity. And it goes to a very core question, which is Australia an Asian nation? Now, in dealing with this issue, Australia has, in large part, lent much more towards the idea that Australia is physically located in Asia, but is fundamentally not an Asian nation. And I know saying that will be quite provocative for some. And my evidence of that, in part, is the episodes of anti-Chinese violence that we have witnessed in our history from the Goldfield days, which for my mind I would broadly describe as phase one of Sinophobia or Sinophobia version 1.0. And that was in the 1860s, right? 1860s, 1870s. And when you look at the historical material of the time, the ways in which the other, the Chinese, were often described as diseased, needed to be purged, and all those sorts of things, are actually framings that continue to reemerge throughout Australia's experience with China to varying degrees of intensity. But for my mind, it was the passage of the various pieces of legislation in 1901 that consolidated white Australia as part of federation. Right? It wasn't an afterthought. It was a foundational feature of the federal identity of this nation, that it was going to be a nation of whites predominantly, that laid the groundwork, if you will, legislatively for a certain kind of disposition towards Asia. But it also reflects deep-seated dispositions and attitudes about Australians as a white colonial settlement on the one hand, and its relationship to both the indigenous of this country and also people of the region. So for 70 years or so, we had white Australia, which permeated all sorts of areas of life. So in relation to Asia, it sort of had its manifestations in things like yellow peril, reds under the bed, and those sorts of things, particularly in the post-Second World War period, which again, you know, resulted in various forms of political violence. And we then had a window. I often talk about this window, this decade-long window from roughly 85 through to 95, where Australia tried to answer that fundamental question, are we an Asian nation, in a different way. And during that period, there was a significant political debate, if you will, and public debate about Australia becoming an Asian nation in a much deeper and richer sense than merely the happenstance of geography. That window was shut, and perhaps it was a sliding doors moment rather than a windows thing. But from the early 2000s onwards, the general tenor of Australia as a predominantly white colonial nation where the migrants from other parts of the world really had to fit in with the predominant Anglo-Saxon discourse, really took over. And that has shaped Australia's dispositions towards Asia in general, but in particular created the conditions in which the China scare stuff was working with fertile ground.
It's interesting because, like, as you know, I was on the Duran a week or so ago, and, you know, this was one of the questions I guess I was responding to, like, is the turn recently in Australian-China relationships driven by racism? Is it driven by, elite loyalty to the United States? Is it driven by the fear of abandonment of a, you know, geopolitically sort of isolated country? Or is it driven by potentially like an over-reliance on the economic relationship that neglected the, you know, political, cultural, social ties that were also developing along during those times with all the racism, et cetera, as well. So, and your view is very much a big element is the racism and the xenophobia. What do you think about some of those other interpretations, I guess?
Yeah, let me qualify that, I guess, because I don't discount those other considerations. And in fact, I tend to think that we're dealing with a complex package deal. So the reference to the questions of race, as controversial and perhaps as provocative as they often are, because it is uncomfortable, right? It is uncomfortable. But trust me, when you're at the receiving end of the verbal and the physical, it's even more uncomfortable. But it's an uncomfortable topic, but one that we need to be willing to have a dialogue about. And the reason why I bring it to the table is that we actually have a long history of it, number one. And number two, the question that I tried to answer in my own mind is, what are the conditions that make this sort of stuff easy to happen in? And one of the key parts of this condition is that is this little racist scab that you can scratch and allow very quickly. And this was the thing that struck me, was how fast and violent this episode has been. And so, you know, why did it happen? But these other issues too, in terms of, this sense of sub-imperial fealty to the United States, there's no doubt about that. And I think Clinton Fernandez, in his work, deals with that quite thoroughly and demonstrates that, in fact, Australia isn't some kind of passive subordinate, but is actually an active sub-imperial power that consciously, particularly in terms of, I guess, the insecurity industry, consciously frames Australia's interests as being 100% allied to American primacy. And so this sense of fealty to America is actually a very active and conscious act of sub-imperial contribution. Now, there's a couple of dimensions to that which I think are interesting to explore, because one is, again, goes back to Asia and our attitudes towards Asia. And one of the things that I guess has always influenced my thinking about Australia's experience of the country geographically in Asia but culturally detached is Walker's work, which talks about Australia as an anxious nation. So I think that there has always been this deep-seated anxiety about these issues. We haven't become, our hearts haven't yet settled in Asia, and let alone settled with our past. So there's some issues that Australia, that's as part of Australia's own journey that it's just going through. I mean, I don't sit here really saying Australia should or shouldn't. I try and get a grip on hows and whys. You touched on the other one, which is this fear of being abandoned, right? So that's the Gyngell stuff.
Yeah.
So when you've got these two bookends, bookend one, which is Walker and Anxious Nation, and bookend two, which is Gyngell and fear of abandonment, you've actually got some very powerful ways of coming to grips with how and why Australia has a very powerful set of tendencies towards ultimately landing in certain places from a geopolitical point of view. And I'm sure we'll get into some of the nitty-gritty shortly, but I think when you sort of paint it in those terms, the disposition of the nation becomes a little bit more intelligible. But the second thing is that in many ways, the Australian disposition towards the Chinese is actually not that different from the American disposition towards the Chinese over time as well. And there is a difference, which I'll touch on in a tick. But when you go back through American history, it had the same experiences and largely the same reactions to the Chinese in the gold fields. It had the Chinese Exclusion Act. And it's had, again, you know, episodes of significant anti-Chinese violence in recent years. So there's a lot of similarities about how the Australian sort of body politic, if you will, the mainstream body politic has reacted to the world of the Chinese and China. I think the main difference is that Americans bring something else to the table, and it is a millenarian zealotry and a God-given, mission-driven sense of primacy and purpose. And Australia tends not to have so much of that. So America's attitudes towards the Chinese is that the Chinese need to be saved, rescued, civilized and transformed. And if that can't be done, then that's really just evidence that the Chinese are actually the devil's work and ultimately needs to be dealt with as such. And that's where we're at.
In some ways, I sometimes wonder whether the, you know, the old consensus understanding, I guess, that Australia was, you know, economic partner with China, security partner with the United States, and in a way believed in the promise of bringing China into the sort of American-led rules-based international order, the sort of, I guess the, like, I think it was Neil Ferguson who talked about Chimerica. It was sort of formed this group of two where China would agree to be the loyal lieutenant to America, if you like, and the economic powerhouse for America's wealth, but wouldn't want the world to develop in its own way. In a funny sort of way, I think not necessarily intentionally, but I feel a lot of the Australian elites on both sides of politics really sort of allowed the relationship to develop too much in that sort of economic side of things, not enough in the broader political, et cetera, side of things. And so never really confronted the, I guess, the cultural diversity, the political diversity, the multipolarity of the new world. It was always going to be, let's be best friends with China as long as it's on America's terms. What do you think of that sort of thought?
It's a very rich thought. I'm going to try and unpack it and distill it to, I guess, deal with pieces of it. Let's see if I've got some of the core elements. I think the first one is this question of the economic relationship. So that's one, economics. So I'll come back to that. The second one really goes through the richness of the relationship, you know, economics and the rest. And the third one is this question of America's, of Chimerica. There's a few other elements to, I think, your commentary, which we might, I guess, tease out progressively, but they're the three that really springs out to me. On the question of the economic relationship, I think that there's actually, again, a need to bring some richness to this discussion. People often talk about this dependency, if you will, on China. And the word dependency is a very loaded word. Trade is a very interesting thing, right? Because it means that both parties have a certain level of, quote, dependency on the other. And so you know, the idea that Australia becomes too dependent on one, in a sense, it also shows that the other is quite dependent on Australia. Now, what does that mean? Well, it could actually be reframed as relationships of exchanges of equivalents. That's one. But the other part of the economic question, which no one ever talks about, is that Australia's biggest foreign direct investor is actually the United States. Australia is heavily dependent upon the United States and has been historically for another facet of its economic development, and that is investment. The United States or United States-owned companies are the biggest player of foreign capital on the ASX. Just saying. Right. So this idea of dependency, you know, cuts in many ways. So that's probably the first thing I'll say, that dependency isn't just a bilateral relationship.
And just to drop in there, Warwick, also, like, this was a huge issue during the 2008 financial crisis as well, because there was a real concern that the flows of capital to Australia would sort of disappear. As I recall it.
Absolutely. And there was contagion risk because of the incredible exposure at a capital markets level to the United States capital markets. The second thing is the depth of the relationships. And I think that there is something to that. For a period of time, and let's go back to that window or that sliding doors moment, there was a significant commitment by government, at the very least, to broaden out the relationship into the other facets, in large part to buttress the economic stuff. But nonetheless, a residual consequence would have been these other elements becoming more well-developed. And I mean by that a recognition that cultural and linguistic capabilities was actually something that Australia needed to commit more effort to cultivating vis-a-vis the nations and the peoples of our north. Now, in 1992, the Queensland government was tasked by the Council of Australian Governments, COAG, with the responsibility of preparing a report on Australian, on Asian languages and cultures education in Australian schools as a strategic necessity for Australia's economic development and engagement with Asia. Now, I worked on that report, and that report carried the name the Rudd Report.
And this is Kevin Rudd, who was later Prime Minister, but at that point he was the head of the Cabinet Office in Queensland as a kind of politically appointed bureaucrat. Yeah.
And I was Kevin's research officer. Was my official, the research officer to the Director General of the Office of the Cabinet. And I was a member, of course, of the Research and Drafting Committee, and worked closely with Kevin as Kevin engaged with bureaucratic and political leaders across the public sector during the preparation of this report as part of both consultations and advocacy. Now, that report came up with a whole raft of recommendations, but the guts of it was, in essence, if Australia is to maximise its economic opportunities in relation to Asia, it needs to pick up its act in relation to linguistic and cultural competency. And to do that, Australia badly needs to invest in the education system so that Australian children would have these skills. The practical manifestation of that general thrust was a recommendation that funding be committed to ultimately ensuring that all Australian children from year three onwards would be able to mandatorily study one of four Asian languages, no prizes for guessing which, Mandarin, Chinese, Bahasa Indonesian, Japanese and Korean, and accompanying that, the cultural curriculum. the traipsing across the countryside, meeting with directors general of education and training and treasuries and things like that during the course of that report's preparation, ultimately led to a commitment from COAG, so all states, territories and the Commonwealth, to share annual funding of $1 billion at the time, annual funding. So half of that would come from the Commonwealth and the other half would come on a pro rata basis from the states and territories. Firstly, to actually train up a cohort of teachers. Problem one, if you want to do this at scale, you need plenty of teachers. Now, this funding ended up seeing this program through to about 2002. So about 1995, the National Asian Languages and Schools program kicked off, but it came to an end in 2002. And incidentally, I read a report recently, can't remember offhand where it was, but I read a report recently which estimated that Australia's peak Asia literacy was actually 2002. And it's been downhill ever since. Now, ever since then, Australian languages policy has once again been a hodgepodge. And it hasn't had that sense of national strategic alignment and commitment in the way that it did in the mid-1990s. My recollection is that the Rudd government, when Rudd became Prime Minister, sought to re-enliven something of the sort. But ultimately, it hasn't really taken hold. So, in effect, for the past 22 years or so, which let's say it's a generation and a bit, Australia has not been cultivating the depth and the breadth of Asian literacy that governments at the time in the 1990s collectively of all political persuasions recognised was a fundamental necessity for Australia's economic prosperity and Australia's security. So in part, the decisions that were made to cut programs like this back in 2002 are now bearing fruit with the events that have taken place over the last 10 years vis-a-vis China. So that's your conjunctural stuff. Yeah, so if there was long durée, this stuff's the conjunctural stuff. In the early 2000s, which is your reference point, right? Chimerica, G2, Neil Ferguson, etc. There was a view that, and this view was echoed through the Clinton administration, which was laying the groundwork to bring China into the WTO, that by bringing China into the WTO and engaging and entangling China in essentially global neoliberal.
So you were saying the Clinton administration.
The Clinton administration was developing a view that by bringing China into the fold, so to speak, which was essentially the post-Cold War American-led unilateral economic system, if you will, that by admission to the World Trade Organization, that America would be able to drive a whole range of changes and liberalisation, et cetera, into China. In short, to transform China and mould China in a shape that made China more to America's liking. Arguably, in the eyes of some, that meant making China a mini-me, right? Making China just like us, but subordinate to us. And you see that in the record of the 1990s with this ambition. But there were debates in the US at the time. There were folk who were hostile to that idea. They didn't want China brought into the fold, into the global trade fold. They didn't believe that China would change, et cetera, et cetera. Now, of course, those folk who believe that China wouldn't change will be now saying, well, in fact, they are saying, I told you so. But the insight here actually is that there was a deep sense from certain elements of the American political elite that, one, the mission of America was to transform China, was to rescue and save it, to deliver it from barbarity on the one hand, and two, the way to do that was by roping China in and entangling China into an economic system over which the Americans believe they controlled or pulled all of the relevant strings. Fast forward then to 2018, and you had a series of essays start to appear in Foreign Policy magazine that in effect represented a sense of buyer's regret that this 16 years, 18 years of, quote, engagement, unquote, did not fulfill the promise of transforming China to America's liking. And when that realization came, the posture towards China fundamentally changed. It was already seen as a risk in geopolitical terms and in all sorts of other ways well before 2018. Go back to the pivot and even before then. But it crystallized at that moment of acceptance that the mission to rescue China and deliver it from, insert whatever it is that you think you're delivering China from, failed. And we get confirmation of that from Jake Sullivan, who incidentally was a co-author of one of the pieces in 2018, which spoke like this. But Sullivan gave a talk earlier this year that explicitly said, we've tried to mold and change China over the so many decades, and it hasn't worked. So this confrontation, if you will, between American missionary ambitions and the refusal of China to yield has led America, or contributed to American public policy elite, ultimately taking an increasingly hostile view towards China. There's even more to it than that, because this attitude towards China goes back over 100 years. Again, the long durée, the missionaries that were sent to China, the belief that the proselytization of Christianity through China was one of the last frontiers, together with West Asia or the Middle East, as you'd call it. These were the last frontiers for civilization, manifest as Christianity, and that the mission in China was to achieve that. And in fact, prior to 1949, which was the end of the Chinese Civil War, the Americans had a very strong belief that through the KMT and Chiang Kai-shek, they had the right guy, because for them, the KMT and Chiang Kai-shek would fight their war. And partly their war was a missionary war. It was a spiritual war.
Indeed, just as a historical footnote, America had a not insignificant role in the Opium Wars and in the Taiping Rebellion, which you know had a Christian millenarian dimension to it as well. Yeah, that's really interesting. And I guess, I mean, at the moment we appear to be in a situation where Australia's been dragged into a full dimensional war against China at a military level, at a kind of a information war type effort. Like, you know, we've had the head of ASIO talk about, you know, Chinese controlled Australian politicians in the last week or so. Paul Keating, whenever he makes remarks critical about how Australian foreign policy has gone, there are people out there on Twitter who regularly accuse him of being a stooge of the Chinese Communist Party, all that sort of thing. But also this sort of economic war as well. And one of the ways in which that seems to manifests itself is sort of industrial policy, I guess, out of America at the moment. but also the in the same way as there's sort of red scares in a military level, there seems to be a sort of China scare about the looming social and economic collapse in China because its demography and its economic system is in repair. And you've written a bit about that in recent times as well. I mean, did you want to maybe just offer a couple of thoughts about all of that?
Look, the China collapsism trope, if you will, in part goes with the missionary purpose of engagement with China, which is to transform China. And if China's not going to transform and be molded in our image, then it's clearly going to fail. Ipso facto, if it's not like us, it can't succeed. And because it's not like us, it is now necessary for a narrative to be constructed which talks about it as impending failure. Oddly, of course, at the same time, the demonization of China, which is necessary as part of the scare campaign, presumes the opposite, which is that China's far from collapsing, but is actually on the verge of taking over the world. You can't have it both ways, of course. So in a sense, the sort of perspectives that are hostile towards China split off into these two camps. They're only unified by one thing, and that is that China didn't become like us, and therefore we don't like it. And it's either going to fail or we're going to have to fight it because it's going to take us over. The enlistment of Australia into this American posture towards China, in many ways, is just an episode of Australian sub-imperial policy. But it does reflect, again, some of the contradictions, if you will, or unresolved issues that we've touched upon about Australia's identity vis-a-vis itself, and as a result of that, its own sense of its place and its role in Asia today and Asia in the future. There's a word that gets used a lot, which I think is overused, and that is the word of agency. So the debate often revolves around, when people say Australia is following in the footsteps of America, you're accusing Australia of having no agency. And then, of course, people will say, but, surely Australia has agency. As a student of history, I'm sure you know that agency is always conditional anyway. You can only do the things that you can address through the lenses that you've got available to you. If you can't conceptually see something, then there's no way that you can develop a response to it. That's the first thing. So this sense of agency comes part and parcel with a historical frame which has over time institutionalized itself as a bunch of, in a sense, reflex actions. And the reflex actions have been predominantly that Australia needs to be under the wing of one of the major Anglo powers, whether it's the UK or the Americans, and that it's in Australia's interest for either the British Empire to have continued to succeed, which it didn't, and because it didn't, we're now, our interests as a nation are now fully tied with the interests of American Empire. But there's that frames things. Now, that's not to say that somehow there's an absence of agency. That's a nonsense distinction, the idea of determinism versus, freedom of action. But the conditions that make possible certain decisions and the ways in which they impact upon judgments about the future probabilities of things are heavily historical. So the discourse now is China's the threat. I don't think you see that explicitly in the official documentation. It's always a bit silent, but it's the one thing that no one talks about. It's the elephant in the room. It's the he who must not be named, all that sort of stuff. Then you get a few think tanks who say, look, Australia's problem is that, we don't allow an explicit referencing of China as the threat, and therefore we can't have a meaningful debate or discussion about China. Well, you don't actually have to mention China to know that all of this discussion revolves around some sense that China is a threat, this belief that China is a threat. But of course, when you actually ask or inquire as to what is meant by this notion of China threat and explore in detail what those dimensions possibly could be, the responses are typically vague. In what way is China an economic threat to Australia? The evidence that gets put on the table is, well, China could engage in punitive trade actions, in effect, not buying things from Australia and not selling things to Australia. The experience and research seems to suggest that with open global markets, Australian products will find markets anyway. There's an argument which would say that iron ore probably won't find easy markets in a lot of places at the volumes that China takes, but that's probably the only thing. Everything else, open global markets, there's a destination for the products. If China stops selling things to Australia, what's the problem for Australia? Well, there will be a problem for Australia. It will be mainly around living standards and the cost of doing things, because Australia imports things from China that are of acceptable quality to Australian buyers, whether they're businesses or enterprises, the price that Australians find attractive. To not do that means you've got to find those things from other places. China doesn't monopolize many of those other things, particularly consumer goods and things that Australia imports. So Australia could easily import things from other places, but it will cost more. Just got to bear that in mind. That's the trade-off. So what's the economic threat? What's the economic threat really? Arguably, in fact, not that much. Is it a cultural threat? Right. In what ways does China pose a risk to this amorphous thing that we describe as Australian culture? And in what ways do we think that Australian culture is vulnerable to this kind of undermining or attack by the cultures of other places? Australian culture is a hybrid of lots of things. I think that's fair to say. But one of the foundational pieces of contemporary Australian culture is actually American culture. So if Australian culture is going to be vulnerable to China in whatever guise, what we're really saying is that American culture is quite weak in terms of its foothold in Australia, which I would suggest is at best stretching the argument. I don't see anywhere where this amorphous thing that we would loosely call Australian culture is at risk of anything. Is at risk of anything. Is China a threat to the, quote, Australian way of life, social way of life, the ways in which Australia makes collective decisions about things? And, of course, in what ways is Australia's way of life, its social setup, its institutions so vulnerable that others can threaten it in the way that makes the public policy blob talk about these threats as if they are existential? I seriously doubt that there's any facet of Australian social life or any public institutions that Australia has through which it makes its collective decisions are genuinely and seriously at risk. It's a total furphy, unless you assume that these institutions are actually incredibly fragile. Now, I've been here 46 years. It's not quite my whole life. But I don't think any of these institutions are that fragile. If anything, they are far more open to influence from the Europeans, the English, and the Americans than they are to the Chinese. Because Australians want to be influenced by those things. What else is China
a threat? It's interesting.
A threat to our geographic integrity? Is China or anyone a threat to our geographic integrity? When you do risk assessments, Risk is about getting to grips with two related things. One is the probability that something may happen, something bad. The probability, right? And the severity of the consequences to you should those things happen. There's lots of things in life where it's highly probable that something will happen, but the consequences aren't very severe. There are things in life where the probability is also very high, but the consequences are severe. Now, they're things to worry about, right? When the proverbial is more than likely or almost inevitably going to hit the fan, and when it hits the fan, the effects are going to be devastating. Be worried about those things. But in terms of risks to Australian territorial sovereignty, how probable is it that any nation, given our geographical distance, the nature of our terrain, the nature of our geology, the oceans around us, the intervening islands and archipelagos that sit between us and other major population and landforms, given all of that, firstly, how likely is it that a successful threat to territorial integrity can be posed as a single event? And secondly, how likely is that threat to be persistent? In other words, should someone invade this territory, how probable will that invader be in being successful in occupying this territory? And I don't think there's anyone serious, and I say that deliberately, who actually thinks that any of that threat is highly probable and that sustaining the occupation is even possible, let alone probable.
Yeah.
Those who suggest that
it's just
run a scare campaign, fanciful. But it's not serious. It's not serious. The last piece, Jeff, I think, is how is China a threat to Australia's environmental integrity? The things that make Australia quite distinctive in the world, the Great Barrier Reef, the ecology and all those things. Well, how is that a threat to that? Well, there's an argument that says, well, if China didn't buy all this ore from Australia, then Australia wouldn't go about ripping up the earth and da-da-da. I get that argument. But prior to COVID, Chinese tourists provided Australia's tourism sector, which was heavily focused, incidentally, on our ecological marvels, with incredible resources to protect them and an incredible incentive to protect them.
Yeah, that's right.
So
that's
right. What's this threat stuff all about?
Yeah. I mean, it seems to me that the driving threat that has driven so much of the, I guess, the government decision-making really over the last 10 years or so, and the media discourse, because I think the media discourse is very tightly connected to, the politics of the day, is the threat China poses to the American world system, really, and the very significant investment of the Australian elites in politics, I'd also say in the media, probably even potentially academia as well, and certainly in the sort of defence security sort of world, in that American liberal rules-based order. So I think the crucial thing for Australia really to do, and I guess is editorial for me really, but I think the crucial thing for us to do is to have the really for the first time in our history to choose to be a middle power within a multilateral system rather than the white dominion of the British Empire, the very powerful and very important white dominion of the British Empire. I mean, we weren't in any way like a irrelevant vassal. We were actually quite crucial. And then similarly, the the anchor of the Indo-Pacific for the sort of American world system. And, you know, host of Pine Gap and all that sort of thing. So it's sort of like we need to sort of change both our attitudes towards China, but also our attitudes towards how we conduct ourselves in a genuinely diverse, diverse world, multipolar world.
In part, the first thing that we've got to come to grips with is how it is that we've framed ourselves and our relationship with the world and what we think is happening in the world. In our neck of the woods, for instance, there is clearly a debate in the foreign policy / insecurity industry fraternity about whether or not American primacy continues to exist, particularly in Asia, but also at a global level, or whether in Asia in particular, we have already moved away from American primacy and have already entered into something that is a dynamic and fluid sense of multipolarity. Now, those who believe that American primacy still exists today, particularly if they have a sub-imperial frame, will logically adopt the posture that says, well, we must do everything we can to preserve what there is. Those who believe that the world has changed and that's multipolar will then split into two camps. One camp says, well, we need to reframe our posture to the world that navigates our position vis-a-vis multipolarity and think about how we contribute to this evolving fluid multipolar ecosystem, which is the editorial that you just outlined. Or alternatively, there are those that, in essence, express the anxiety which says, my goodness, multipolarity is emerging, primacy is fading, and we must do our best to help America recover primacy. So that brings those two threads back together again. It's either to defend primacy or to recover primacy. I'm not sure that there's anyone now who's serious who actually continues to hold the view that primacy exists. There's a few pockets of it here and there, a bit of chest beating, but most serious observers, including people in America, actually have the view that the problem that America has is that primacy is fading. That's its problem. So all of this effort is about recovering that through a two-step move. One is to hold the other guy back, the Tonya Harding move, if you will, hack them at the knee, slow them down, to give America time, America and its allies time, to reassert primacy and to rebuild primacy. That seems to me to be the rough lay of the land. Question should Australia play a role in the reclaiming or the efforts to reclaim primacy, and what are the implications of that? And more broadly, I ask myself, is sustained American primacy or sustained efforts to recover American primacy and all the things that need to go into trying to get that back, is that compatible with sustained peace and stability within this region? And my proposition is that American primacy and efforts to reclaim it are fundamentally anathema to peace and stability in Asia going forward. Now, if that proposition has some merit, then the question for an Australia is, well, what part does Australia now play? But what are the consequences of that? Because accepting that as the new reality, if you will, also implies accepting that primacy is no longer worth pursuing. And that's the big call, because that requires a fundamental reassessment of whether Australia is an Asian nation, and what our relationships are to the two bookends. The anxiety of being in Asia and not being Asian, and the fear of being abandoned by a big protector because we're not Asian, but in Asia.
And potentially also it means broadening out, our understanding of what an Asian nation is as well, because, like, you know, back in the 80s, 90s, Asia kind of largely meant Eastern, Southeast Asian Asia. Nowadays, absolutely, it includes India. Increasingly, it needs to think about Central Asia. It perhaps also should, think that Russia is an Asian country as well. Most of it is in Asia. And you know, what's happening in West Asia is part of Asia as well. So that, I mean, obviously East Asia and Southeast Asia is our immediate region, but I guess that I feel there almost needs to be a broadening out and a re-energizing of what our concept of the Asian century sort of thing is, to use that old
idea. It's a big challenge, Jeff, though,
a few years ago.
What you're saying.
Yeah.
It's a big challenge because it actually requires a fundamental rewrite of the frame that has provided both comfort and security to those who have been interested in these things. The idea of a revitalized Eurasia, all the way from the Urals through West Asia, Central Asia, and across to East Asia, and then down to Southeast Asia.
Mm.
The idea that that has a cohesion, and that that cohesion brings with it economic heft and a security interest as well through institutions like the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, requires a fundamental reorientation of how Australia thinks about the world.
Yeah.
And at this stage, observing the way that the debate largely gets played out in Australia, the conditions are not yet there for these reconsiderations to even be canvassed, let alone be taken seriously. That's a challenge for Australia, right? Because the world is changing around us. It's all about how Australia firstly understands what those changes are, and does it accept that these changes are happening? And secondly, then, how Australia adapts itself and its posture and its interrelationships with others vis-a-vis this changing context. So you got that big backdrop. The big backdrop really is not just the rise of an individual country like China. The big backdrop is actually a change in the global system. And the global system that's changing is happening right at the economic foundations of how the global interconnections work. The flows of energy, the flows of food, the flows of technology, the flows of people, know-how, and all those sorts of things are reconfiguring. They've been reconfiguring now for the best part of 15 years. China happens to have been a catalyst because of its scale, its heft. You know, if you want to talk about a rock being dropped into someone's pond, China's growth, by virtue of its heft, has dropped a boulder into the pond. So it's reconfiguring economic value flows. It's also, by virtue of that, creating the conditions whereby those who have been at the periphery of the world system for the best part of the last so many hundreds of years are finding a pathway back to the table. Right? No longer are they going to accept being placed on the menu, to borrow from Tony Blinken. These countries have the confidence and the courage now to say, you're not putting us on your menu, thank you very much. We're going to have a seat at this table, whether you like it or not. We'd rather you like that and embrace every possibility that that brings. But if you don't like that and want to put us back on the menu, well, we're going to have something to say about it. So this is the challenge for a country like Australia. So if the editorial about a normative reposture towards being an active middle power is to become materially possible. Australia's public policy elite and the institutions that sustain it need to have this reckoning first. It's a big reckoning to have.
Yeah. And perhaps the, you know, perhaps more achievable first step is to, I think Hugh White in his essay from a year or two ago about Sleepwalk to War, you know, Australia's unthinking alliance with Asia, talked about the need to have a honest and assertive discussion with America about the fact that America's not going to rule the world from now on. And you know, potentially Australia is a trusted and important ally within the global sort of system for America, you know, has the position to be able to say you really need to accept a changed role in the world, and you know, clinging on to primacy risks the world, you know, the world's security ultimately. I mean, arguably we could do that rather than, if you like, what how, I mean, if I would summarize our current sort of perspective as saying we're trying to put steel back in the spine of American primacy to convince America that it really can do everything. Like, it's like when Julia Gillard went to speak in Congress, whatever it was, 10 or more years ago, you know, she said, you know, you're the country that put a man on the moon and you can do anything kind of thing. And Australia seems in many of its decisions to have been sort of playing that role of saying to America, of course you can, of course you can, of course you can, when perhaps it should be saying, of course you can't continue to play the role that you have over the last 30 years. You need to come to terms with the world as it is today.
I went to the US a couple of times last year, and I saw a few things. I won't dwell on some of the harsher facets of America. I'm sure people are aware of what they are. But what I continue to see is a capacity amongst people to think boldly, to be courageous about themselves and to potentially be ambitious for themselves and their nation. All of that said and done, of course, it doesn't mean that that enables America to reclaim, either at a narrative level, at a level of imagination, or in reality, a position that many in America think that they occupied previously or did occupy previously. So I guess in many ways, I think that America does have incredible capability. How can you not? 340, 350 million people, tremendous accomplishments under its belt. But it does have its own challenges, and it needs to come to terms with those challenges and actually become comfortable with itself, because right now it's not comfortable with itself. And when America isn't comfortable with itself, isn't at peace with itself, it's not going to be at peace with the rest of the world. And perhaps the conversation that Australia may wish to have, and it's a may, because right now the conversation predominantly seems to be that, look, we'll do whatever you want us to do to try to get primacy back. That's the dominant tenor of the discussion. But the alternative discussion is actually, look, there's things that America needs to deal with, really domestically. And whilst it's not for Australia to tell America how to deal with those things, the more successful America is at dealing with those things, the greater the example it sets to the world. And perhaps that's the kind of conversation that Australia could be having with America today. But I don't think Australia is ready, and I don't think America is ready for that conversation that you described.
Yeah. Well, that's perhaps a great point to end our incredibly fascinating, rich conversation, except perhaps I might just ask you one last question Warwick. I know you've been very generous with your time and dealing with a few technical hiccups, but and I guess, you know, like all these big diplomatic conversations, obviously most viewers can't really participate in any way, unless Kevin Rudd's watching the show right now. I doubt that's the case. In terms of ordinary, you know, ordinary people, the viewer who's interested to actually have a better understanding of China's role in the world today and its history, and how that affects relationships with Australia, affects relationships with the United States, where's some good places from your experience to start, just in terms of being better informed about China and better informed about its history? Because often it's, you know, there's a lot of agendas in some of the stuff that's written about other countries by people from other countries. So it can sometimes be a little bit hard to work out what's a good place to start. What would you recommend as some good places to start?
It is very difficult at the moment because I guess I don't like to use the word balance because it sort of implies that it's a, you know, a bit of this and a bit of that, right? But a perspective on say China that is actually far more grounded is actually quite hard to find. And in part it's because you've got these two things. You've either got the China collapse stuff, or you've got the China's about to take over the world stuff. Now, if ever, and so my first, I guess, comment, if you will, or suggestion for people to ponder as they seek to explore this space a lot more is, if they get a sense that there's any of this within anything that they're consuming, you probably just park it, right? China's not going to collapse, but China's not taking over the world either. So that's the first thing. These perspectives are just not serious. Then I think we start to get into trying to address what's going on. Now, public policy in China is difficult to understand if you haven't delved into this world before. And I would suggest that rather than reading big fat books and all those sorts of things, that people just jump online and find voices that are voices of curiosity, voices such as this program and other programs as well, that are curious about how 1.4 billion people are thinking about their place in the world, are trying to deal with the day-to-day challenges of marshalling the resources, coordinating their actions, dealing with day-to-day problems, dealing with strategic problems. So just explore, right? But be warned, every time someone says it's about to collapse or it's going to take over the world, just ignore it, move on. That stuff's not worth it. Find the other stuff that actually says, look, it's a big country. It has a legitimate place in the world. It has challenges that it is trying to deal with in ways that make sense to it. And understanding that takes time and effort. Now, look for me, I guess, and find stuff that I'm doing. But I'm not the only voice. I think that there's plenty of good stuff, both ground up, people in China who tell very grounded stories about what's happening in China, some of which is actually like travel logs and cultural blogs, right? I really like travel logs and cultural blogs. There's two in particular that I like. One's done by an Australian woman living in China. I think it's Blondie in China or something, where she does a weekly food blog. I think it's fantastic because it's so grounded, right? And it's about something that surely we can find common languages around, which is the enjoyment of food, right? And the second one is actually a blog done by a young American woman who's working in China now. Catherine, I think is her name. I can't remember the details of her channel, but she works for an organization that is involved in environmental stuff. And she's been doing vlogs for ages. And they're all, again, just grounded stuff about things that that is happening in the village where she lives and her travels and things. And they just give you a window into this grand and complex kaleidoscope. That's China. Mm. Not from a Chinese point of view. Mm. These are two very Western perspectives, right? But I suggest that because in some ways those particular channels, particularly for people who aren't Chinese but are wanting a pathway in, may find to be easier channels to navigate. And I think that that's a great start.
Yeah. And it's sort of a bit free of all the, you know, heavy agenda kind of stuff. Yeah.
None of the other stuff. Yeah. Right? Like, if you want geopolitical content, don't go to those two. Right. If you want to get a window into life and people, they're great starting points.
Which, in the end, is what we all really need to do. That's right.
If it's not about life and people, I don't know what it's about.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'll make sure I include links to those channels in my video description. You should make sure you send them to me so I can do that accurately.
I don't know either of them personally, but I've seen their stuff, and I think this is just really nice people-to-people stuff, right?
And that's one of the wonders, I guess, of the internet. You know, it has its flaws and its barriers and all that sort of stuff, but you can actually discover the real experience of people all over the world reasonably well if you're, you know, just a little bit curious and a little bit careful about it. So,
look, the last thing I should say, Jeff, is one last thing, just parting point, which is often people have this sense of wish. They wish that something is, and that does often cloud the way that you approach the world. If you can become mindful of the fact that we all have our own wishes and our normative perspectives, but be conscious of what they are and leave them at the door, right? And let the voices of others just wash over you. Just let them be. That's actually, from my perspective, a nice starting posture. And if we go back to the earlier comment, which is that I've lived and breathed this challenge, you know, this cross-cultural challenge my life, a part of dealing with that is to actually accept that what I may wish may not be what the other wishes for.
Yeah, that is a wonderful thought on which to end, Warwick. Thanks so much for this conversation about China and the world and I guess how we can all live together at peace, hopefully, and with, you know, compassion for each other.
Appreciate your time. Thank you.
Well, that was a wonderful conversation. I am sure you agree. A big thank you to Warwick for his generosity of spirit, time, and insight. Everyone, until next week, take care and remember, what thou lovest well will not be reft from thee.